You're listening to Fakeologist Audio Chat. To connect to our always-on and always-streaming audio chat, go to fakeologist.com/radio3. To participate in the chat, go to fakeologist.com/audio chat. Each day, we compress and upload the day's chat, be it big or small. Leave a quick message, do a whole show. All are welcome when it's related to fakeology. Now, on with today's audio.
Good evening, everybody. This is Faye on Fakeologist Audio Livestream on March 6, 2018. It is 20:07 in Middle Europe, and I am about to read a text because I believe that this text is quite important for. Oops. Loud and clear or louder and clearer, Napoleon? Am I too loud? Am I too low? Okay. I will find out. Okay. So, I was saying it is a text about the three articles written by Jean Baudrillard concerning the first Gulf War, as it is called. And in this text, which is about 20 pages, it takes about an hour. I read it when I came from work home in the train, and my train time is about 47 minutes. And I didn't finish. I left 2 pages off, so I guess it is about an hour. And I'm going to comment also at some points, so maybe it takes a little longer. Why is this text important? I want to explain this first, because otherwise, I mean, I could also read some fairy tales in the live stream. Actually, this would be a good idea, I think, if someone would do that. But no, this is not a fairy tale. It's about the first Gulf War, which has been written down, let's say, in the history archives as a virtual war, or as a war that was fought out, let's say, in the media. It was a media happening, at least, or it was a war which produced extremely intense photographic or imagery material. Maybe those who are old enough and remember. I remember it because I was old enough, and I actually viewed some hours of the broadcast that was published those days, because it was very fascinating. It was a green-black light with lightning, and you didn't see really anything in these pictures. You just knew what you were told, and all you were seeing was this green surface with some lightnings far away, which were set to be, I don't know, some rockets or whatever, missiles or bombs. And it was always the same. Whenever I looked into TV broadcasts those days, in some cafes or whatever was possible, it was always the same. It was very fascinating from that point of view. I was too young to understand it. I just, my thoughts that time were that somehow a perversion, that I can view this bombardment happening on a TV station somewhere in Athens, and at the same time there where it is set to take place, there are real people. So it was really very intriguing, very confusing. Jean Baudrillard wrote about this. Jean Baudrillard is some guy in, was some guy in France who has been integrated in the history of the last century as that thinker who advanced the idea of reproduction of material, matter. The evolution of these concepts were, as we saw in one other monologue that I did, from they began with the Gutenberg printing machine, but the main steps for this concept was Walter Benjamin in the 30s of the last century, with one very famous text he wrote about the productivity of the artwork, of the work of art, where he, work of art is just the symbol for any kind of matter in that text, and he analyzes it and comes to the conclusion that since reproduction in an industrial way is possible, there is no original. Everything is a reproduction. Potentially, everything is a reproduction or can be a reproduction, which means that nothing is localizable. Nothing has a real point of existence in the real world. That's somehow the beginning of the theory of the simulation and virtualization and all this stuff. And this guy Baudrillard was the one who took over from Benjamin and some others who were in between, and of course the technology, because the technology is always first, and they, I'm not sure about that. Maybe the thinkers just think a little bit prior to the technology, that the technology is going to come. Anyway, Baudrillard advanced or conceptualized it even further, this concept, and he added to it for the postmodern era that this is not only reproduction, this is not only the loss of the original, which means also, and it's important, which means also the loss of the existence as a singular entity. So any one of us is somehow just a reproduction. What is in its core, it is the proto-fascistic and the proto the proto-fascistic theory of the valueless life, let's say. Okay, I said that only because I wanted to say who is Baudrillard. I guess most of you know him anyway. So he took the events of the first Gulf War, and actually he wrote before, during, and after the Gulf War, he wrote these three articles where he states mainly that what we now are experiencing, that is not just somewhere is a war. This is some new kind of, this is a new paradigm of war. This is a new type or a new concept within, or a new form in which war is materialized, is taking place. It has often been misunderstood as if he was saying, oh, there was no war in the Gulf. That's just bullshit. It was a hoax. But one has to understand also his theory and his analysis of media and propaganda. And because I'm not so good in talking, I just selected now this text to read about this analysis of Baudrillard about the First Gulf War. Yes, there is the title. Okay, this text is written by Paul Button, I think I have to put him in the live stream. He's the one who did the English translation for the three articles of Baudrillard, published in 92. And he's in some university in the States. I don't remember now exactly, but one can look him up. I'm going to read, and when I stop in order to comment about something, or if maybe someone would like to jump into the live stream because he's very interested, or she is very interested to talk about this stuff, I would be really happy. We can also interrupt text at some point and just discuss freely afterwards about this topic. Okay. Jean Baudrillard's article, The Gulf War Will Not Take Place, was published in Libération on 4th January 1991, a little over 1 month after the UN Security Council had voted to authorize the use of force in Iraq, if Iraq had not begun to remove its troops from Kuwait by January 15th. And a little under 2 weeks before the American and British air attack on Baghdad and Iraqi positions in Kuwait. Far from being deterred by the unfolding situation, he wrote two more pieces similar lines. The Gulf War, Is It Really Taking Place?, which referred to the events during February 1991, and The Gulf War Did Not Take Place, which was written after the end of hostilities on 28th February. Part of the second article appeared in Libération on 6th February, while a fragment of the third article appeared in Libération on 29th March 1991. All three pieces first appeared in extended form in the book published in May 1991. Let me see the note about this book. I'll set up the text now. Yeah, it was the French publication, La Guerre du Golfe n'a pas eu lieu, Edition Gallier, 1991. The central thesis, I continue with the text, the central thesis of Baudrillard's essays appears to be directly contradicted by the facts. What took place during January and February 1991 was a massive aerial bombardment of Iraq's military and civil infrastructure. According to some accounts, the amount of high explosive unleashed in the first month of the conflict exceeded that of the entire Allied air offensive during WW2. This was followed by a systematic air and land assault on the Iraqi forces left in Kuwait, which culminated in the infamous Turkey shoot carried out on the troops and others fleeing along the road to Basra. Official estimates of lives lost as direct casualties of these attacks are in the order of 100,000, but these do not take into account the subsequent loss of life due to hunger and disease. On the face of it, Baudrillard could not have been more wrong. So why did he pursue this line of argument which appears to deny the reality of the Gulf War? At the time, the TV Gulf War must have seemed to many viewers a perfect Baudrillardian simulacrum, a hyper-real scenario in which events lose their identity and signifiers fade into one another. Fascination and horror at the reality which seemed to unfold before our very eyes mingled with a pervasive sense of unreality as we recognized the elements of Hollywood script which had preceded the real, the John Wayne language and bearing of the military spokesman. And as the signifiers of past events faded into those of the present, the oil-soaked seabird recycled from the Exxon Valdez to warn of impending eco-disaster in the Gulf, occasionally, the absurdity of the media's self-representation as purveyor of reality and immediacy broke through in moments such as those when the CNN cameras crossed live to a group of reporters assembled somewhere in the Gulf, only to have them confess that they were also sitting around watching CNN in order to find out what was happening. Television news coverage appeared to have finally caught up with the logic of simulation. I interrupt here just for a moment to say that that is a very important articulation which he makes now, because that is what, if we look now reverse to the past, in 2001 this was manifested very clearly, that the television and the media in general have replaced completely the reality, which of course does not mean that there is no reality. It just means it is not this what is being showed in the media. At that time when these texts were written, even though these people are the most advanced, let's say, in this the understanding of this matters, they had this approach that we are now hearing about, reading and hearing about, and which is quite vague. Okay, I'm continuing now with the text. It was not the first time that images of war had appeared on TV screens, but it was the first time that they were relayed live from the battlefront. That's also important. It was not the first occasion on which the military censored what could be reported, but it did involve a new level of military control of reportage and images. Military planners had clearly learned a great deal since Vietnam. Procedures for controlling the media were developed and tested in the Falklands, Grenada, and Panama. As a result, what we saw was, for the most part, a clean, quote-unquote, war, with lots of pictures of weaponry, including the amazing footage from the nose cameras of smart bombs, quote-unquote, and relatively few images of human casualties, none from the Allied forces. In the words of one commentator, for the first time, quote, the power to create a crisis merges with the power to direct the movie about it. Desert Storm was the first major global media crisis orchestration that made instant history. Just a minute, I want to look up who said that. That is George Gerbner. He wrote the book Persian Gulf War, the movie, published in Triumph of the Image, The Media's War in the Persian Gulf, A Global Perspective, blah, 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 Boldner and Oxford, Westview Press, 1992. Was that published? Okay, I continue now. The Gulf War movie was instant history, in the sense that the selected images, which were broadcast worldwide, provoked immediate responses and then became frozen into the accepted story of the war. High-tech weapons, ecological disaster, the liberation of Kuwait. In case anyone missed the first release, CNN produced its own edited documentary, quote, CNN War in the Gulf, quote, which was shown on TV around the world. Within weeks of the end of hostilities, Time Warner produced a CD-ROM disc on Desert Storm, which included published text, unedited correspondence reports, photos and maps in the form of a single hypertext document. In their publicity, They described this interactive multimedia disc as a, quote-unquote, first draft of history. First draft of history. Okay. I'm still here. For those who know my addiction to cigarettes, you know also what I'm doing now. Okay. I continue with the text. In the precession of simulacra, Baudrillard took as an allegory of simulation the Borges story, for those who don't know him, Jorge Luis Borges, a great author, and he wrote prosa, he didn't write media theory. For his theory, Baudrillard took as an allegory of simulation the Borges story, in which the cartographers of an empire draw up a map so detailed that it exactly covers the territory. Thanks to the geographical data collected by the U.S. Defense Mapping Agency, remote corners of the American Empire, such as Kuwait, already exist on hard disk. Just as it marked a new level of military control over the public representation of combat operations, so the Gulf War displayed a new level of military deployment of simulation technology. Technological simulacra neither displace nor deter the violent reality of war. They have become an integral part of its operational procedures. Virtual environments are now incorporated into operational warplanes, filtering the real scene and presenting air crew with a more readable world. That's also a reference here. Michael Heim, The Metaphysics of Virtual Reality, New York, Oxford, 1993. Never heard of this guy. So what he's saying is that the virtual, let's say, paradigm or the virtual chapter or part of that is not separated and separated from the real part. They are interwoven. They have evolved into a new state of war, one can say. I continue. The development of flight simulators provided an early example of the computer technology which allowed the boundaries between simulation and reality to become blurred. The images and information which furnish the material for exercises and war games become indistinguishable from what would be encountered in real conflict. The same technology now allows the creation of simulated environments in which to train tank crews, and even the possibility of connected simulators in which virtual tank battles can be fought out. An article in the first issue of Wired recounts developments in the use of networked simulation machines as training devices. So actually, that's now a comment of mine, actually all that was put in place on 9/11/2001 was long ago produced and used and deployed and evaluated. It was not a premiere, let's say, of something. It was a premiere, but because of other points that 9/11 had. I continue with the text. Within months of the end of the war, army historians and simulation modelers had produced their own multimedia, fully interactive, network-capable digital simulation of one of the tank battles from the closing stages of the conflict. Quote, armchair strategists, can now fly over the virtual battlefield in the stealth vehicle, the so-called Cygnet, flying carpet, viewing the 3D virtual landscape from any angle during any moment of the battle. They can even change the parameters, give the Iraqis infrared targeting scopes, for instance, which they lacked at the time. This is virtual reality as a new way of knowledge, a new and terrible kind of transcendent military power. That was a quote, the quote is now closed, yes. That was a quote from Bruce Sterling, or Sterling, War is Virtual Hell, in Wired, 1993, page 95-96. Oops. Baudrillard at times portrays the Gulf conflict as one between a relentless and pre-programmed military machine and a hysterical trickster, a rug salesman, whose essential weapons include the ruse and the decoy. Quite apart from the Orientalist overtones of this image, it underestimates the role played by dissimulation and deception operations within Allied military strategy. Electronic warfare involves new forms of deception by means of interference and falsified signals. In the Gulf, such technological dissimulation was combined with old-fashioned tactical deception maneuvers on the ground, with apparent success, or with apparent success. American agents even succeeded in introducing a computer virus into Iraq's air defense command and control system. Seen in this light, the use of the media to pass disinformation to the other side, we are talking still about an other side. That's my comment. I continue with the text. Seen in this light, the use of the media to pass disinformation to the other side is simply another dimension of a consistent strategic embrace of the logic of simulation. The Gulf War thus witnessed the birth of a new kind of military apparatus which incorporates the power to control the production and circulation of images, as well as the power to direct the actions of bodies and machines. It involved a new kind of event and a new kind of power, which is at once both real and simulacral. Baudrillard's essays pursue a high-risk writing strategy, courting equally the dangers of contradiction by the facts and self-refutation. They occasionally force the facts to fit their own rhetorical oppositions. For example, in claiming that, quote, no accidents occurred in the war, everything unfolding according to programmatic order, quote, unquote. They rail against the proliferation of useless commentaries, yet do not hesitate to offer commentary of their own, for example suggesting that there are more tricks to the wily Arab opponent than the Pentagon strategists suspect. This is Baudrillard as armchair strategist and expert in the stratagems of symbolic exchange. Now here I take a break, because this is one of the main concepts in the theories of Baudrillard, and it is through all his writings, it is that what gives him his view on everything. It's from the book, is, I'm not sure how is it entitled in English, I just translated now, it is The Symbolic Exchange and the Death, and it describes as an abstract, I would now translate it in my language, as an abstract concept that existence is always in an ironic relationship to the world. It is always reciprocative, but never it is fulfilled. So if A is, let's say, world and B is existence, the flow between those two is ironic. It is not equivalent. So it is impossible to exchange the existence with something. That's a very deep concept, and actually I like it very much, but do not want to talk about it anymore. He's just referencing it here, and I do once more read this sentence. This is Baudrillard, the previous set. This is Baudrillard as armchair strategist and expert in the stratagems of symbolic exchange. They denounce the emptiness of the media event, but also seek to endow it with the status of being an exemplary non-event. But these are not scholarly analysis of the events themselves, nor even of their media representation. Baudrillard is reluctant to claim the status of philosophy, sociology, or political analysis for his writing, but equally resistant to its dismissal as literature or poetry. That is a critique. He puts him in his place. He says, okay, that's everything is good what you tell us, but it is only good in that category of thinking. It is not applicable if you want to analyze media reality or media deception or whatever. It's not good for everything, and that's of course true. In time and with a little imagination, he has since suggested it will be possible to read the Gulf War did not take place as if it were a science fiction novel. These are occasional essays by a writer who believes that writing should be less a representation of reality than its transfiguration, and that it should pursue a fatal strategy of pushing things into extremes. This comes, of course, out of the leftist past of Jean Baudrillard and the dialectic of history, of the Marxistic theory, which by pushing things to the extreme means that the dialectic is not as it is. We can also influence the dialectic, and by pushing things to the extremes, pushing the dialectic relation to its maximum potency, then comes revolution. That is the myth of the dialectics of history. They are also immediate responses to instant history TV and its first draft versions of the print in the print media. As such, they belong in the series of his essays, which includes the discussion of the staged massacre at Timisoara and the equally provocatively titled response to a television link-up with Sarajevo, quote-unquote, "No Pity for Sarajevo." It's in the same theoretical concept. The timing of their composition is important. The Gulf War will not take place was written in December 1990 and January 1991, when the final act of the Gulf crisis was still to be played out. At one level, the response expressed in this article is a kind of fuite en avant, a sardonic challenge to the media hype surrounding the Gulf crisis. The point being made is that the events which were unfolding did not and would not correspond to what Baudrillard called the archaic imagery of media hysteria. This imagery object of media speculation was total war in the 1940s sense, including the use of chemical and perhaps even nuclear weapons. Of course, he believes in nuclear weapons, War in that sense did not take place, even though massive damage was inflicted by means of conventional weapons. Baudrillard's response to the subsequent events pursues the symbolic challenge to the manner in which these were portrayed. It is not irony so much as the kind of black humor which seeks to subvert what is being said by pursuing its implicit logic to extremes. So you want us to believe that this was a clean, minimalist war with little collateral damage and few Allied casualties? Why stop there? War? What war? Rhetoric aside, Baudrillard's first essay is also a response to the question which remained open at the time. Will there or will there not be war? His answer points to an irony in events themselves, which derives from the fact that war itself has become virtual. The hypothesis of, quote, the Gulf War will not take place, unquote, is that the deterrence of war in the traditional sense has been internalized and turned back upon the Western powers, producing a form of self-deterrence which renders them incapable of realizing their own power in the form of relations of force. Others call this also the inversion of war or something like that. I've heard it, but maybe it's, I'm not sure. Maybe it's from this journalist, I'm not sure. Under present conditions, Baudrillard argues, the virtual has overtaken the actual. It functions to deter the real event and leaves only the simulacrum of war, which will never advance to the use of force. Quote, we are no longer in a logic of the passage from virtual to actual, but in a hyper-realistic logic of the deterrence of the real by the virtual. The underlying argument of this initial essay is that the logic of deterrence has transformed the nature of war. Comment here? That's, of course, the deeper meaning of all this critique, and now when I view it backwards, I realize how difficult it must have been to understand what was going on. I mean, even now, almost 30 years later, it's quite really difficult to understand these categories in which we, because we exist in these categories, or our own logic is constructed in relation to these things. So but of course Baudrillard has also his tics, as I say, in articulating his theories. Okay, I continue, but I would like to repeat this last sentence because I found it important. The underlying argument of this initial essay of Baudrillard is that the logic of deterrence has transformed the nature of war. Deterrence is a matter of the virtual existence, exercise of power. Action upon the action of the other by immaterial means. It is a means of waging war, but one in which the aim is precisely non-engagement or the avoidance of direct encounter between the parties involved. The Cold War was indeed a war, one that has been fought and won, but increasingly by economic, informational, and electronic means. My comment here, phacological, of course, this chapter with the Cold War has not yet been analyzed, I think, enough, because there are many signs about simulated or at least simulated events or series or whatever concepts that were placed in that time to work, which actually fit into this description that this writer and Baudrillard are viewing as that it has started or was materialized with this Gulf War. And for us, or for me at least, I thought always with 9/11 it was it started. But as I see now, it goes back and back, and maybe it was always like that, I don't know. I continue with the text. The Cold War was indeed a war, one that I read that already, but increasingly by economic, informational, and electronic means. It was a war fought on the principle of deterrence on the basis of an economic R&D and informational effort to deter any use of material force by the other side. It was won when the Soviet economic and political system could no longer maintain the effort. In the process, Baudrillard suggests, war evolved in a manner parallel to the evolution of capital. Just as wealth is no longer measured by the ostentation of wealth, but by the secret circulation of speculative capital, so war is not measured by being unleashed, but by its speculative unfolding in an abstract, electronic, and informational space, the same one in which capital moves. This does not, this does not mean that it is unreal in the sense of not having real effect, any more than a capital crisis is unreal because it takes place in the electronic and informational space of digitized and networked financial markets. Example, the crisis of 29, the financial collapse, was virtual, but the crisis was real. That's something that's also, we forget it sometimes. Rather, it means that state-of-the-art military power is now virtual in the sense that it is deployed in an abstract, electronic, and informational space, and in the sense that its primary mechanism is no longer the use of force. So, for my understanding, that's a comment now, for my understanding, this is somehow like the definition of psychological warfare, which we use in the psychological context. And, it's psychological, always has to do with psychology. And psychology is one of the sciences. So, that's a big topic which can be refined, or what's the name for that? I continue. Virtual war is therefore not simply the image or imaginary representation of real war, but a qualitatively different kind of war, the effects of which include the suppression of war in the old sense. That describes really our times. Shortly after the publication of The Gulf War Will Not Take Place, the bombing began in earnest. At the end of that essay, Baudrillard offers a reason for undertaking what he calls the, quote, stupid gamble, unquote, of attempting to demonstrate the impossibility of war in the Gulf just at the moment when all the signs were pointing in the direction of its occurrence, namely the stupidity of not doing so. The stupidity in question is that of those critics who uncritically participate in the supposed realism of the information industry, or the stupidity of taking a position for or against the war without first interrogating the nature and type of reality proper to events such as those which unfolded in the Gulf and on our TV screens. So what does it mean? As I understand it, it means that Baudrillard, when he says the Gulf War cannot take place, he says we have to analyze this war in a different art than the previous wars, because it is a new kind of war. It is not a war fought in the traditional manner, but it is a, whatever, some say a third, fourth generation warfare, or psychological warfare, or deception warfare would also be possible. I continue. For Baudrillard, in these essays, quote, it is not a question of being for or against the war. It is a question of being for or against the reality of the war. Analysis must not be sacrificed to the expression of anger. It must be entirely directed against reality, against the evidence, here against the evidence of this war. Accordingly, a primary concern of the second essay, which is the Gulf War, is it really taking place, unquote, is to interrogate the nature of the Gulf War as a media event. This is not a war, but a simulacrum of war, a virtual event which is less the representation of a real war than a spectacle which serves a variety of political and strategic purposes on all sides. Here, the sense in which Baudrillard speaks of events as virtual is related to the idea that real events lose their identity when they attain the velocity of real-time information, or to employ another metaphor, when they become encrusted with the information which represents them. In this sense, while televisual information claims to provide immediate access to real events, in fact, what it does is produce informational events which stand in for the real and which inform, quote-unquote, public opinion, which in turn affects the course of subsequent events, both real and informational. As consumers of mass media, we never experience the bare material event, but only the informational coating which renders it, quote, sticky and unintelligible, unquote, like the all-soiked seabird. He says it for the second time. I think it was this, was it this? No, maybe it's older, because this Psyop with BP was later, wasn't it? But somehow I know this bird also. Where was this image captured, and what oil spill caused it? Who caused the oil spill to begin with? To the extent that real events are mediated or portrayed by such selected images, they become contaminated by what Baudrillard calls, quote, the structural unreality of images, unquote. The result is a new kind of entity, qualitatively different to, quote, real, unquote, or imaginary, quote-unquote, events, as these were understood prior to the advent of modern communications technology, namely, virtual media events. These are informational entities, and one of their defining characteristics is to be always open to interpretation. Informational events are thus the objects of endless speculation, because a range of interpretations is always possible. The identity of such events becomes vague or undecidable. Baudrillard's Gulf War essays provide many examples of such aporia. For example, throughout much of its duration, the war is both a non-event, an empty war in the sense that there is a lack of real engagement between the combatants, and an excessive, superabundant war in terms of the quantity of personnel and material involved. On the one hand, the American decision makers are unable to perceive the other in any terms but their own, and as a result, they misrecognize the strategic aims of Saddam Hussein. On the other, Hussein is entirely a mercenary, beholden to outside forces, and it is the West which is in conflict with itself in Iraq. Finally, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait may be represented as the outcome of the megalomaniac ambitions of a local dictator, or as the result of a deliberate ploy on the part of the American administration in order to legitimize its projection of force into the regime. That was now the political lever. The images of war, nonetheless, have real effects and become enmeshed in the ensuing material and social reality. In this sense, Baudrillard argues, we live in a hyper-reality which results from the fusion of the virtual and the real into a third order of reality, that's the hyper-reality. Much has been written since the Gulf crisis about the role of the media in promoting the military option and about the practice of misinformation, lies and propaganda on both sides. There is no doubt that such things occurred. One of the more effective propaganda stories about Iraqi atrocities.
You're listening to another hour of Fakeologist Audio Chat on Fakeologist.com.
There is no doubt that such things occurred. One of the more effective propaganda stories about Iraqi atrocities in Kuwait was the eyewitness account before a Congressional Human Rights Caucus of Iraqi soldiers removing babies from incubators and leaving them to die. It later emerged, It later emerged that the witness was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States and that she had been coached by a public relations firm, Knowles and Hilton, or Hilton and Knowles, I don't remember now, hired by the Kuwaiti government. On the other side, television footage of an outraged woman amid the rubble of an Iraqi neighborhood was later shown to have featured an assistant deputy foreign minister and former ambassador to the United States. For some critics, such manipulation constitutes an abuse of the democratic right of information, to information. However, the danger of a critical response, which is confined to the denunciation of such abuses, is that this also sustains what Baudrillard calls a hypocritical vision of television and information. It judges the media by reference to a moral idea, namely that of a good or truthful use of images and signs. In fact, there is nothing inherently good about images or signs, and they can just as readily be employed to deceive as to tell the truth. As Baudrillard argues in his article on Timisoara, the indignant attempt to maintain a moral defense against the principle of simulation, which governs all forms of representation, misses the point, quote, the image and information are subject to no principle or truth or reality, unquote. In this sense, it is cynics such as Saddam Hussein and the US military commanders who are less naive and hypocritical in their willingness to control information and images in whatever ways best serve their strategic ends. Quote, we believe that they immorally pervert images. Not so. They alone are conscious of the profound immorality of images. Informational events such as the Gulf crisis are endemic to postmodern public life. Since they are by definition always open to interpretation, they may be made to serve a variety of political ends. They are an important vector of power. What matters is to control the production and meaning of information in a given context. In effect, at least two strategies are in play with regard to the control of information in contemporary public life. During the quote-unquote life phase of a significant event, such as the Gulf conflict or an election campaign, the strictest control of information is necessary in order to influence future developments. Wherever public opinion can feed back into a political process which includes the event in question, image and interpretation, or quote-unquote spin upon, current developments is vital. That is why the Gulf War movie was also an influential part of history, even as it unfolded. Of course, my comment, because it replaced the real event. It replaced the, let's say, images which could have been produced with the older concept of war that was a little bit more, let's say. That's, I think, the main difference is that with the older paradigm, it was just leaning on the representational context. So, for example, eight parts were maybe analog to the reality, and two parts were woven, interwoven with that to misguide or misinform or transform the information that was contained in a picture, let's say. But here we have the complete virtual content. The pictures that shown from the Gulf War were not pictures from the Gulf War. They were pictures from computers. But we didn't know it at that time. I didn't know it. I'm sorry. Okay, I continue. The images of destruction and death along the road to Basra did not fit the script of the world's first high-tech clean war. Where enemy forces are reliant upon TV news for information, as it is argued, the Iraqis were during the Gulf conflict, it becomes possible to employ the media directly as a conduit for disinformation. During the preparations for the land offensive, media reports of US Marines along the Saudi border with Kuwait and on amphibious ships off the coast were part of a calculated and successful strategy to deceive Iraqi commanders about the likely direction of the assault. Reports of such deliberate deception imply that the use of media reports as part of the Allied military's operational conduct of the war was more extensive than even Baudrillard suggests. However, once the life phase of the event is passed, another strategy takes over. The proliferation of archival information, including taped audiovisual records, allows the event to become utterly dispersed into a morass of conflicting interpretations and hypotheses about what really happened. Did Saddam Hussein undertake the invasion of Kuwait against all indications, or was he lured into a trap by US policymakers? Who was really responsible for the assassination of JFK? And who killed Laura Palmer? I guess you know who Laura Palmer is. And if not, you can ask me. It is this latter effect of the proliferation of information which sets limits to the effectiveness of the kind of critical media analysis which seeks to discover the truth of events. Which seeks to discover the truth of events. The author of The Persian Gulf TV War, Douglas Kellner, recounts his Herculean efforts to obtain and cross-check information about the Gulf War. Despite this, his book opens with an admission of failure. He cannot decide conclusively for or against the conspiracy theory according to which the U.S. enticed Iraq to invade Kuwait, since, quote, other accounts are also possible, unquote. Comment from me. We know that. As fecologists, I now dare to call myself a fecologist, because I'm here since, I think, 4 months. But, okay, just kidding. But this confusion is the confusion that, I mean, these guys would be really better in the fecologist surroundings. They would have clearer concepts would be possible. Okay, I continue. I cannot express myself now. Yes, he said, this guy who wrote the Persian Gulf TV War, quote, other accounts are also plausible, unquote. It is the desire to avoid the kind of informational aporia which lies behind Baudrillard's injunction. Quote, resist the probability of any image or information whatever. Be more virtual than the events themselves. Do not seek to re-establish the truth. We do not have the means, but do not be duped, and to that end, re-immerse the war and all information in the virtuality from whence they came. Be meteorologically sensitive to stupidity. That sounds quite religious now for me, but now with the optic of ecology, I actually understand what he says here, which is very articulated, but actually I understand he says that when you see the movie about the Iraq war, you do not have to interpret the pictures, because the pictures are fake. They are just virtual pictures, CGI or whatever kind. They cannot tell you what happened in Iraq. You have to find it otherwise, or let it be. I continue. Meteorologically sensitive to stupidity, okay? Not only does the real vanish into the virtual through an excess of information, it leaves an archival deposit such that generations of video zombies, generations of video zombies will never cease reconstituting the event, unquote. Yeah, sure. Some videos, my comment, some videos were not good enough, so they try to destroy them now. They try to take them out of the internet. If someone goes into the net and searches for, let's say, the Hazarkani shot of the plane impact into the South Tower, if I'm right, you cannot find it. They are trying to take out all this and cleaning the historical record of the 9/11 fakery catastrophe. I continue. And even if we did possess the means to establish the truth, what difference would this make? For every book exposing the lies and inhumanity of U.S. policy in the Gulf, there are two more which champion it as the defense of democracy and the New World Order. Christopher Norris regards Baudrillard's Gulf War essays as a definitive exposure of the intellectual and political bankruptcy of modern thought and a demonstration of, quote, the depth of ideological complicity that exists between such forms of extreme anti-realist or irrationalist doctrine and the crisis of moral and political nerve, unquote, which afflicts Western intellectuals. According to Norris, Baudrillard's quote-unquote absurd thesis about the war readily accord with a postmodern mood of widespread cynical acquiescence. I cannot read this word. Acquiescence, and represent a form of quote-unquote theory which is, quote, ill-equipped to mount any kind of effective critical resistance, unquote. Comment from me, we can smell that here is one speaking of political correctness, which, if we remember, became en vogue after the first, that namely Gulf War. It was in the 90s. This movement of political correctness tried to save the classical academic intellectual thought, which was drifting away to either this paranoid or half-paranoid anti-realist stuff, as Baudrillard, as he calls Baudrillard, or just not saying anything about the reality because they have not any tools to interpret it. I continue. Claims of ideological completion notoriously difficult to prove or disprove. But there is little in Baudrillard's essays to suggest, suggest a quiescence in either the political or military operations carried out in the Gulf or their portrayal by the media. Indeed, the tone and argument of Baudrillard's essays is entirely directed against the complicity which results from the failure to question the reality and the nature of these events. Norris's own rhetorical stance is one which suggests that alternative theoretical approaches offer the prospect of, quote, effective critical resistance, unquote. Yet Baudrillard at least published polemical pieces which addressed the political and media reality at the time. Norris seized the occasion to renew his campaign against the whole postmodern tendency in contemporary theory. Actually, my comment, this is not really interesting because it's just infight between the intellectual schools after the 90s or the late 80s. I continue. His argument, largely Norris's, this political correctness guy, his argument largely repeats that of his earlier article on Baudrillard and the politics of postmodernism. On the one hand, he concedes the descriptive value of Baudrillard's account, allowing that, quote, this is indeed, in some sense, a postmodern war, an exercise in mass manipulative rhetoric and hyper-real persuasive techniques, which does undoubtedly confirm some of Baudrillard's more canny diagnostic observations. That was Norris about Baudrillard. On the other hand, he rejects the epistemological skepticism which he takes to lie behind this postmodern tendency and questions the supposed connection between the diagnosis of the postmodern condition and this philosophical conclusion. The flaw which runs through all postmodernist thinking is a confused epistemological argument which begins by denying that we have any means of access to, quote unquote, what happens, other than what is provided by the media, and ends by concluding on this basis that there is no, quote, operative difference between truth and falsehood, veridical knowledge and its semblance, unquote. Understood in this manner, the thesis that the Gulf War did not take place would indeed be ludicrous and would hardly justify the effort of a lengthy essay in reply. But epistemological skepticism founded upon the logic of representation is not part of Baudrillard's argument. Not only does he make truth claims about what happened, his interrogation of the reality of the media Gulf War presupposes that this is a different kind of event from those which occurred in the desert, a simulacrum rather than a distorted or misleading representation. These essays advance no universal claims about the collapse of the real into its forms of representation, but rather make specific ontological claims about aspects of present social reality, such as the virtual war, which results from the strategy of deterrence, and the virtual informational war, which we experience through the media. At one point, it is true, Baudrillard reminds us that the direct transmission by CNN of information in real time does not prove that war is taking place. However, his claim that the Gulf War did not take place does not depend upon the possibility of such technological fraud. Rather, it relies upon the two distinct notions of virtual war involved in deterrence and media simulation, and upon questioning whether the military operations undertaken by the Allies really constituted a war in the traditional sense. Useful criticism would engage with these notions rather than, as Norris does, attack a soft target of the critic's own invention. Maybe I have to skip here, because now comes Chomsky, and I don't feel like reading Chomsky now, but it's only one part. I skip Chomsky, whom you for sure know already better than I do, and now we continue with the conclusion of Paul Patton. The claim that war itself has become virtual does not mean that military conflicts do not occur. They do, and with increasing frequency and savagery in the New World Order. But these are secondary phenomena, like the persistence of sweatshops alongside fully automated production facilities. They are the consequences of a law of uneven development located for the most part in a political and military third world, where they do involve first world powers such as the US or UK. It is because they are in conflict with third world forces who do not recognize that the rules of the game have changed, or who, like Saddam Hussein, operate according to different rules. They are police operations rather than wars. In these cases, deterrence breaks down for lack of any common ground, and it is this failure of communication which leads to the use of force. However, the use of force remains carefully circumscribed, a lever of last resort employed only to the extent that is necessary to bring the recalcitrant party into line. The crucial stake in the Gulf affair, Baudrillard argues, was the subordination of Islam to the global order. Quote, "Our wars thus have less to do with the confrontation of warriors than with the domestication of the refractory forces on the planet. All that is singular and irreducible must be reduced and absorbed. This is the law of democracy and the New World Order." Unquote. This is not war, and even if it were, in the case of the Gulf conflict, it is as though it never happened. The final irony of the whole episode is that, apart from the massive damage and suffering inflicted upon Iraq and the short-lived political and economical benefits at home, and he means the United States home, very little changed as a result of the military conflict. The Iraqi regime was allowed to remain intact and its army permitted to crush the Kurdish and Shiite rebellions. The rights of Kuwait may have been restored, but in exchange for the rights of minorities in Iraq. The image of a just war fought between the forces of freedom and those of tyranny dissolved in the moral ambiguity of the post-conflict period. The same Americans who had systematically destroyed Iraq's power grid and transport infrastructure now refused to enforce the law of democracy and the New World Order, where this would entail intervening in the internal affairs of a sovereign state. From a political point of view, it was no longer clear what had been gained by the sacrifice of so many lives. A perfect semblance of victory for the Americans was exchanged for the perfect semblance of defeat for Iraq. In short, the Gulf War did not take place. That's a little bit the style of those guys there that are the French impregnated, as I call it. They have to have a literary style for themselves, and they love to conclude with the beginning and all this somehow maybe quite also Masonic style. I'm not sure, because I'm not so well introduced into the Masonic theory or imagery or whatever. Does anybody like to speak with me a little bit about this stuff? Is anybody around and listening? And better I will stay here for a moment. Maybe someone joins me. I see there is not many are green. So Etik Luna, I listened to him. I now remember it's Luna, but it's him. But maybe he's too young. There's not so much interest in this old Galfor. Or maybe Folios Hatios, if he can hear me. Napoleon Wilson, I don't think he is in the mood for talking. Okay. I hope you are all well, by the way. And this YouTube strike or purge, or what is the name exactly? It's really crazy that what worries me about that is not that the YouTube channels are closing, because I'm quite new in this kind of research, and as I told you many times, it's a year and something, and I had about 200 channels on YouTube which I was following, mostly very small and investigating, I don't know, researching anaconda malt liquor, and then from one another you find all these guys who analyze psyops and stuff, and and now I have accounted, I have only 8 left. They are not closing only now very fast, but there is a qualitative difference, I think. After this Parkland event, I read it also, and I heard it also from others, that there are thoughts that this hawk survivor was actually placed or scripted like that, so that he can suck all the interpretations of the so-called conspiratorial alternative scene, and so that they can legitimize such a purge against YouTube channels that are working like in that direction. All this I found very not normal. I don't say normal, but I don't know the right word. It was expected. So it was not unexpected, let's say. But what I found very intriguing was, I don't unfortunately have the reference for that, because it's one newspaper there, one there, and I don't know, different signs, but many of them, that there is a, from my understanding, there is an intention very clearly and very offensively in this phase to relate analysis of psyops with far-right ideology. Actually, not only with analysis of psyops, but also transvestigations. Just today, maybe I can find it again. It was just an hour or two ago when I read it. One transvestite, officially a declared transvestite, quitted her job, or his job, I'm not sure, because he or she was being harassed from far-right other guys, I don't know, on the workplace. And it was a big article, I think it was in The Guardian, but I'm not absolutely sure. That is somehow something that makes me a little bit not worrying in the sense, I don't know what exactly means worrying in English. I mean, that it gives me to think. It makes me think about, because the separation, let's say, of an internal opponent in a country was actually always the left, and since Trump, we have for the first time something like the, like, but they cannot say Trump is far right, because there is no difference between Trump and Clinton. They are the Republicans. I don't know the politics in the States, but I just mean it has maybe also a broader political concept which is there working, but of course their information, they are killing by critical information with this, with this attempt to close all these channels. And yes, of course, there are other places where you can go, but it's just not the same. YouTube is a platform. It has become a platform since it was bought by Google. And information will maybe continue to be produced, but it will not be consumed so widely. I don't know. Okay. Nobody seems to be in the mood to talk. Okay. So, I wish you a very pleasant night or day or afternoon or morning, and I hope we meet again soon.
Hey everybody, this is O'Hallahan from South Korea, and you're listening to Fakeologist Radio on Fakeologist.com.